Okay.
All right. So I'd like to begin by thanking you all for being here today, and especially to thank you for the invitation to be here. Though I did come from the University of Southern California, I run an excavation in Rome in the summers, so I actually didn't come that far to be here today. But definitely a change of weather has happened. So my talk today concerns Dionysius of Corinth and what he can tell us about Christianity in Corinth and the wider Eastern Mediterranean in the second half of the second century. Dionysius, as Professor Breitenbach just noted, is the subject of my forthcoming book, which I'm shamelessly pushing again on you, that will be published in September by Cambridge. In the book, I dwell at great length on how thinking about Dionysius's letters in the context of Corinthian trade and networks offers us a way to rethink the historiographic frames that we use to study early Christianity in conversation with people like Bruno Latour and Gilles Deleuze. In this paper, I have a decidedly less lofty set of goals. Since Dionysius is such an understudied figure in early Christianity, I want to spend my time today talking about what we can know about Dionysius, given the sparse remains of his network of churches and his literary archive. I'll begin with a few brief remarks on Dionysius and how he has been studied by scholars of early Christianity. Then I turn to problems related to how we can know what we can know about Dionysius before finally turning to his letter corpus, of which I'll focus on a couple of his letters. Eusebius's information on Dionysius comes from a collection of the bishop's letters that Eusebius possessed in his library in Caesarea. And we only know about Dionysius because he was summarized and quoted by Eusebius himself. So we have no independent access outside of Eusebius to the letters of Dionysius. As Eusebius describes it, the collection contained 9 letters. Of these letters, 7 were written by Dionysius to other collectives: Sparta, Athens, Nicomedia, Gortina, Amastris, Knossos, and Rome. 1 letter was written to an individual, a woman named Chrysophora. And finally, the collection also included a letter written in response to Dionysius's letter to the collective in Knossos, penned by its bishop, Pinitos. These letters comprise the only information that we possess about Dionysius. Now, we know that Dionysius was alive and serving as bishop in Corinth sometime in the late 60s and early 170s. We know this because his letter to the Romans mentions Soter as the bishop of Rome. We know of Soter from several sources and can place his term of office roughly between 165 and 175. Dionysius was not the bishop of Corinth during the Quartodeciman controversy in the 190s, when the Corinthians were governed by Bacchylus. We can thus hypothesize that Dionysius was born in the second quarter of the second century, making him a younger contemporary of Ignatius, Justin Martyr, and Marcion, among others. That he had passed by the 190s makes him an older contemporary of Irenaeus. Whether he was born in Corinth or migrated to the city later in life is unknown. My slides are not advancing for some reason, but I'm going to try to fix that. Okay, there's a map of his letters, and we'll now put up this. Okay. Dionysius has not been treated extensively by scholars of early Christianity. Walter Bauer saw Dionysius as a lackey of Rome, an arm of Rome's soft power as the church of the imperial city began to exert its influence over larger swaths of territory. After Bauer, Pierre Notin offered a rebuttal, arguing that Dionysius was very much his own man, and in fact was working subtly against the interests of Rome. Notin saw Dionysius as a moderate on issues of celibacy, repentance, and the readmission of penitent heretics, though a moderate who actively fought against more rigorous bishops and actively worked against Marcion. Notin's reconstruction remains compelling in many respects and is usually the portrait endorsed by scholars who only make passing reference to Dionysius on the way to more interesting projects. To give you a sense of how uncrowded the field of Dionysian studies is at present, I can round out the history of scholarship with 2 more sentences, which you can't really do in the second century very much. Wilhelm Kunert offered a testy rejoinder to Notin, arguing for some historical agnosticism in a 1979 Festschrift article, and in 2002, Carl Leon Nothlitz offered an update to Notin in a JAC supplement volume that offers a compelling synthesis between Notin and Kunert. That basically rounds out the field. That was easy. Okay. So one of the central arguments of my book is that studying Dionysius requires a different way of mapping early Christian difference and diversity, one that might also help us to write other histories of early Christianity. Dionysius sets does not fit into the prevailing binary of orthodoxy and heresy that has governed early Christian historiography since Irenaeus in the late second century. Nor is Dionysius covered by the important work that has gone into defining the various varieties of early Christianities. For example, Dionysius's fight with Bishop Penitus of Corinth, about which we'll talk later, pits two authors that Eusebius claims were orthodox against one another over questions of celibacy. While Eusebius tries to smooth over this debate, its existence allows us to question the fixity and homogeneity of orthodoxy, as well as its usefulness in describing the differences that were sites of debate among second century Christians. This is a topic that I cover in my book, and it's worth keeping in mind as I tell you more about Dionysius. Now, an important methodological issue needs to be dealt with before reconstructing Dionysius and his network. As I have already noted, everything that we know about Dionysius comes from the fragments and summaries of a collection of his letters in Eusebius's Ecclesiastical History. Because the evidence for Dionysius comes via an intermediary, it's important to be clear about how to work with this intermediary source. First, we should note that Eusebius frames his reading of Dionysius's letters by calling him orthodox and God-inspired, amongst other things. This frame puts Dionysius in a particular box for Eusebius and should make us careful about how we read Eusebius's quotations and summaries. For example, we have no guarantee that the quotations are themselves indicative of the rhetorical focus of the letters themselves. In the broader context of Book 4 of the Ecclesiastical History, Eusebius is concerned with finding and mentioning as many bishops as he can between Hegesippus and Irenaeus, that he can claim as both orthodox and as bearers of stable series of apostolic successions from earlier apostles. In his summaries of Dionysius's letters, Eusebius is always at pains to mention the names of any bishops mentioned, even in the case of Palmas, bishop of Amastris, who is only mentioned, he says, by name in a letter. He further draws out the names of prominent early Christian characters, like Peter, Paul, Dionysius the Areopagite, and Clement of Rome. He cites the names of these prominent figures so that, by his own admission, the elements of history might be more persuasive. Because Eusebius is so focused on finding Orthodox bishops and other proofs of apostolic succession, his summaries and quotations may be overly focused on ancillary details and not on the major issues addressed in a particular letter. In other words, we have to recognize that all citations in antiquity were done in a particular political-social context that invariably interferes with the original text, and which must be addressed and dealt with in order to offer a persuasive reconstruction of the original text itself. Ultimately, we have to reckon with the fact that citations are used not for precision and reference, but to convince a reader in the context of an argument. These are just some of the challenges that we are confronted with in teasing out information about Dionysius from Eusebius. The difficulties I've raised, though that I said there are more of them, do not offer a clear and straightforward method with which to approach Eusebius, but rather act as cautions against naivete and hubris. For example, in the citation on the slide down here, it's unclear, at least to me, where Eusebius's citation of Dionysius's writings ends and where Eusebius's editorializing begins. And I put the possible thing here in brackets. That may be Dionysius, it may be Eusebius editorializing. Lacking any information outside of Eusebius to compare, all we can do is really speculate. In many cases, we must reckon with the fact that we will not be able to achieve the kind of certainty that we want and be content with ambiguity. However, there is still a good deal that I think we can say through carefully working with Eusebius's text. We can, for example, be fairly confident about some of Eusebius's biases, a desire to find second century bishops that he can link with apostolic orthodox lines of succession and to place clean lines between those he would claim as orthodox from those he would exclude as heretical. Further, we might also get leverage from Eusebius by paying careful attention to places where later theological categories or terms not operative in other second century Christian texts make their appearance in his summaries. Thus, Eusebius often talks about orthodoxy or orthodox teaching, which is probably his imposition of a category from his time on his reading of Dionysius' letters. So I'll pass briefly through Dionysius' letters to a couple of the collectives in Achaia and in Western Turkey, starting here with Sparta and Athens. Top two letters up there. These letters, the letters to the province of Achaia, seem to address different conflicts that have arisen in the province during a period in which many stressors had emerged, such as the wars fought by Lucius Verus in the east and Marcus Aurelius in the north, the invasion of the Costobaci in the 170s, drains and stresses on local economies, and perhaps the emergence of the Antonine Plague. Dionysius's letter to the Spartans reflects little knowledge of the collective itself, but seems to address a context of turmoil in the larger city of Sparta. His letter to Athens offers evidence of persecution against the collective there and turmoil that resulted in the transition from one bishop to the next. Dionysius's letters to Amastris and Nicomedia, so the bottom two down here, show the size of Dionysius's network stretching all the way up to the shores of the Black Sea. This is particularly surprising when we note that Dionysius was urged to write to Amastris by Amastrians named Bacchylides and Elpistos, meaning that connections between Amastris and Corinth had made the journey from the Black Sea to the Aegean several times before Dionysius took up his reed to write against Marcion and in favor of readmitting lapsed members to the collectives there. And I want to focus a bit on two letters from Dionysius's corpus, those to Knossos and to Rome. Dionysius wrote another letter to Crete, commending Philip, the bishop of Gortina, but it was his letter to the Knossians that seemed to have struck a nerve. In his letter to Knossos, Dionysius exhorted Pinitus, their bishop, not to lay the heavy burden of chastity upon his congregation and to take into account the weakness of the many. The first thing to notice about Dionysius' letter is that he rhetorically posited two groups: those who follow Pinitus's presumed burden of chastity, and the many who are weak. This suggests that Dionysius's letter was modeled on traditional homonoia speeches, in which disagreements or factions within a civic body were encouraged to give up their own privileges for the sake of the common good. As we'll see, Dionysius's rhetoric was probably inspired by 1 Corinthians in this regard. Second, chastity is here not described as a blessing or a virtue, but as a burden that is placed onto people. The language here indicates that Dionysius' advice did not figure chastity as the highest of Christian virtues, as we see in other early Christian writings of this time. Dionysius' position was that celibacy was a choice and not a requirement, open to those few who, unlike the majority of the weak, were able to practice it. The invocation of the weak and the consideration that should be taken for them harkens back to Paul's concern over the weak sibling in 1 Corinthians 8, who would be harmed by those in the collective who openly consumed food sacrificed to idols. In 1 Corinthians, Paul's rhetoric emphasizes renunciation of privilege for the sake of the weaker members of the body. To paraphrase Paul's position, though we can all agree that idols do not exist and that they cannot affect the food that we eat, we ought to give up this right so that we do not harm the conscience of a sibling. For Dionysius, chastity is a practice that can be pursued but not required because it represents a burden that's too difficult for the many to bear. Because Dionysius' letter to Amastris was said to contain much in Eusebius' words, a lot probably, or maybe too much is what Eusebius is implying, teaching on both marriage and chastity, it's clear that Dionysius did not teach against marriage. In response to Dionysius' letter, Pinitos offered a subtly worded critique of the Bishop of Corinth's theology and his intervention in Knossian affairs that equally draws upon the terminology and themes of Paul's Corinthian correspondence. Pinitos' letter is as diplomatic as it ultimately is biting. He begins by expressing admiration for Dionysius and commends his letter. In this, Pinitos respects the conventions of diplomatic decorum, even as he takes a harsh line on the content of Dionysius' letter. Pinitos politely asked that the Bishop of Corinth write again to the Knossians with stronger food, with more perfect teachings that can rear up the people in Pinitos' care so that they might not waste their time with milky teachings fit for children. Not something I would like you to say to my talk today. This pointed critique draws on Paul's admonition against the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians 3, where he calls them children who must consume milk because they are not yet able to eat solid food. Pinitos' criticism draws its force from the reversal. Dionysius stands not in the place of Paul offering solid food to others, but in the place of the discordant Corinthians who are yet babes drinking milk. Pinitos further shows that he's playing subtly with Paul's letters by his invitation that Dionysius might write to him something more perfect, a reference to Paul's use of teleos in 1 Corinthians 2:13 and 14. What is also interesting about the correspondence between Corinth and Knossos is the lengths to which Eusebius goes to smooth over the dispute, emphasizing that Penitos was both very cordial and respectful in responding to Dionysius and completely orthodox in his disagreement with the Corinthian bishop. Eusebius is at pains to stress in his summary that Penitos's letter displayed proper orthodoxy, concern for his flock, eloquence of speech, and understanding of divine matters. Eusebius even seems to side with Penitos. In his description of Dionysius's letter to the devout Chrysophora, Eusebius notes that here Dionysius writes of what is appropriate and imparts food of rational discourse, perhaps a suggestion that Eusebius agreed with Penitos that the earlier letter to the Knossians was actually not proper food but milky teachings. Eusebius is concerned to manage the debate between these Orthodox bishops, Orthodox in quotation marks, should not be surprising. Though disputing with Marcion and despite the protestations, however forced, of Eusebius, Dionysius does not easily map onto clear dividing lines between Orthodox and heretical Christian groups. As many have shown since Bawa, the categories of orthodoxy and heresy do not serve us greatly in describing the complicated interactions between and among early Christians. We're better off seeing early Christianity as a series of networks that come together and fall apart, leaving traces that only later are grouped under the headings of orthodoxy and a pluriform heresy. Rather than following Eusebius's desire to categorize and label, we should see the disputes between Dionysius, Penitos, and Philip, the bishop of Gortina, as the result of potentialities for connectivity in the Eastern Mediterranean to connect Christians' collectives together in ways that might elicit cooperation or, just as often, conflict. Dionysius's letter to the Romans offers us another interesting angle with which to explore Dionysius's network. The fragments of the Roman letter are the only quotations taken directly by Eusebius from Dionysius's letters. From the fragments, it's clear that Dionysius's collective in Corinth has received a gift from the Romans, which Dionysius calls an ephodion, about which we heard a lot in the last talk. Ephodion carries with it, as Larry said, a semantic range that can capture both the necessities of existence and the finances that pay for them. We don't know why the Corinthians needed aid from the Romans, but it's clear that they did, and Dionysius's letter represents his attempt to thank the Romans for their gift, while also attending to the fact that the letter that they sent with the gift contained a sharp criticism of Dionysius and the Corinthians. We don't know why the Romans did this, nor what the issues might have been, but we know that Dionysius read their letter as a rough admonishment. He uses nuthesia and its verbal form to describe the letter, and compares it with 1 Clement, which refers to its own rhetorical goal as an admonishment of the Corinthians in very, very harsh terms, as we just heard in that great talk from Larry. Dionysius' response to the Roman letter threads the needle of offering both thanks and apologia. He does this by using the conventions of kinship diplomacy that were often deployed in the tense negotiations between ancient cities. Kinship diplomacy refers to a form of diplomatic rhetoric that relied on appeals to ethnicity and kinship to elicit particular political, military, and economic outcomes. This rhetoric used such elements as common descent, custom, history, language, geography, and cult, each of which might prove certain kinds of affiliation between cities and people. As we've seen, the receipt of money from the Romans put Dionysius in a difficult position. Dionysius and the Corinthians were now in the Romans' debt, a position that the Roman letter used to its advantage by offering an admonition about Dionysius's theological and political behavior, or whatever it is that they were particularly concerned about. By giving money to Corinth, the Romans saw themselves as patrons and the Corinthians as their clients. And this perception of the situation helps explain why they also included an admonition of Dionysius. In his response, Dionysius attempts to defuse the debt that he and the Corinthians owe by rooting the Roman action in an ancient ethos of the Romans themselves, thus skirting a framework of patronage and dependence. Let me go one further here. You can see both of them now. Okay, these are the two quotes that I'll be working on. I need to go back. Sorry. I think I've lost one. Okay. All right. So Dionysius frames the Roman gift within a history of Roman benefaction. According to Dionysius, the Romans have From the beginning, Exarchis and Architen acted as benefactors to many of their siblings, Adelphoi, in other cities. The Roman tradition of benefaction is described in specifically financial terms. So I'm sorry, but I think I've lost that quotation. So you're gonna have to judge me on that one. You're gonna have to trust me on this one. I seem to have done a poor job of editing my PowerPoint. Okay, so the first quotation from the Romans deals with how Dionysius is sort of structuring the Roman action. He talks about how Romans have from the beginning done certain kinds of things, namely given money to other siblings in other cities. The Roman tradition of benefaction is described in specifically financial and material fashion. The Romans have, through their actions, relieved the poverty of those in want. And the language of benefaction places the Roman collection within the discourse of patronage, but Dionysius quickly moves to shift the discussion to a Roman ethos. The phrases that he uses there, exarchis and architen, root the benefactions of the Romans in its origins. This is something that the Romans have done since the beginning, and not only that, the recourse to origins is meant to indicate that such benefaction is a continuing practice that defines the Romans' relationship to other Christian collectives. These disparate collectives spread out over the geography of the empire are linked together by Roman benefaction. Dionysius goes on at length about how the Romans give money to all the siblings in all places. These financial links are described in the language of kinship, particularly the term siblings, which Dionysius uses four times in the fragments cited by Eusebius. Though a common label in early Christian writings, the title of siblings implies a measure of equality between the Corinthians and the Romans, even as the patronage relationship, the father and the children relationship that Larry talked about, governs much of the Roman perception of what's going on. As siblings, the transfer of capital would not fall so cleanly within the confines of patronage as it would between a father and a son. The various Roman gifts to other collectives become not acts of benefaction that create clients for a patronal Rome, but a familial exchange through which siblings generously share resources with one another. The Romans have not just given to the Corinthians, but to siblings throughout the world, and they have done so not out of particular political interests, but because that is what they have always done. This ancient practice of Roman benefaction is presented as an ethos of the Romans, a custom that speaks to something essential and fixed about their identity. As such, by giving money to the Corinthians, the Romans, quote, have guarded the custom of the Romans handed down from their ancestors. The work that Bishop Soter, as Minister of External Affairs, put into organizing the collection has added to this legacy, making him analogous to an affectionate father with his children. The ancestral custom of the Romans dictates that they must give to their siblings in need, making the Corinthian gift one of many acts of benefaction that the Romans are obligated to perform. What appears as flattery is a subtle insinuation that the Romans ought to continue to give such financial assistance if they want to be in conformity with the traditions that their fathers handed down from the beginning. Having argued for the appropriateness of the economic interdependence between Corinth and Rome through an invocation of a founding Roman ethos, Dionysius constructs a shared history of the Roman and Corinthian collectives as a means of reinforcing this interdependence. And this is basically what I now have up for you. So again, sorry, I've forgotten to include the first quote. At the same time, Dionysius reuses the shared history as a means of asserting the importance of his see before the Romans. In this passage, Dionysius constructs a shorthand account of the legendary founding of the Corinthian and Roman collectives by Paul and Peter, which he no doubt draws from the suggestions in 1 Corinthians 1, 3, and 9, that the Corinthians were familiar with Peter's ministry, though to the chagrin of many biblical scholars, Dionysius seems to imply that Peter actually was in Corinth at some point. Drawing on Paul's image of the planter in 1 Corinthians 3, 6 through 8, Dionysius stresses the unity of Peter and Paul in their founding of the Corinthian collective and in the teaching which they offered there. It is the same teaching that was delivered later by both Paul and Peter in Italy before their martyrdoms. This construction of the apostolic history of both Corinth and Rome is politically useful for Dionysius in a number of ways. First, this retelling gives Corinth a more ancient claim to apostolic priority, since Peter and Paul taught in Corinth first before going to Rome. Second, Dionysius suggests that the Romans' criticism of Dionysius' theology, whatever it may have been, is misguided, since both collectives received and guarded the same teaching from Peter and Paul. Finally, Dionysius asserts the authoritative status of Corinth with respect to Rome. Though each collective shares in the same legendary founders, Corinth was founded by Peter and Paul, while Rome was the site of their martyrdoms. In both places, the same teaching was offered, though Corinth received it first. The repetition, almost at the expense of coherence, of the language of equality and sameness is striking. For also both having planted in our Corinth equally taught us, and equally also having taught in the same place in Italy, they were martyred at the same time. Dionysius, though remaining respectful of the Romans, places Corinth and Rome at least on equal footing as apostolic sees, if not giving Corinth the advantage between the two. Properly read, the fragments of Dionysius' letter to the Romans helps us to see another way in which the interdependence of early Christian communities was fraught with possibilities and perils. A final lesson I think we can draw from Dionysius' letter collection is the tenuousness of early Christian networks and the deep flaws in our scholarly guild's broader rhetoric of ancient Christianity's success. Dionysius' network of Christian collectives was rather huge, stretching from Rome to Crete to the Black Sea. But by the time of Eusebius, there was nothing left. All that Eusebius knows about Dionysius comes from the volume that he had in his library, and that's all that we know ourselves too. Ultimately, networks are tenuous and fragile, able to be disrupted very easily. Lacking non-local and provisional institutional, legal, or political systems, all that knit early Christian collectives together were social relationships, sparse literary archives, and memories. If such tenuous networks were disrupted, there would be little left to preserve their memory for those outside of the network. Just as networks grow and transform, they also decompose. Whatever came of the relationships that Dionysius worked so hard to form, maintain, and shape, they did not long survive his passing from the scene. While this may cut against the grain of triumphalist narratives of early Christianity's spread, the huge cost involved in maintaining such networks should remind us to expect a great deal more failure than success. As Bruno Latour rightly notes, if there are identities between actants, this is because they have been constructed at great expense. If there are equivalencies, this is because they have been built out of bits and pieces with much toil and sweat, and because they are maintained by force. If there are exchanges, these are always unequal and cost a fortune both to establish and to maintain. The fragile networks of the earliest Christians existed because of the work of many unnamed agents and the expenditure of a great deal of social and actual capital. Of any kind of network, whether it be Walmart's global supply chain or the Christian collectives dotted around the Aegean Sea, we always have to ask how many people maintain it and how much it costs to pay them, and then add that to the bill. Rather than seeing the decomposition of early Christian collectives as part of the victory of the Orthodox in a long struggle with a multivalent heresy, we should note that growth and decomposition are two modalities of historical change. The collectives and networks that endured were constantly reconfigured as they did so, just as others changed by coming apart. I'm not advocating here a historiography of the losers, a framing that would only reinforce the binary of Orthodoxy and heresy by inverting but not subverting the dichotomy. Instead, I would suggest that a recognition that all things come undone actually offers us a better way to understand the traces that remain from early Christianity, like the network of Dionysius. Historians of the early Christians should stop telling stories of a triumphant orthodoxy, the victorious spread of Christianity, the tragedy of competing varieties, and turn their attention to the effervescent bubblings in the organic cultural flows along the shores of the Mediterranean where things come together and fall apart. Dionysius and his network, which doesn't quite fit into any of our preconceived categories, is just one of these effervescent bubblings that came together and fell apart. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Test.
Yes,
yeah,
maybe
there.
I'm going to ask you a little bit about coming together and falling apart. Are you implying that there was not then any survival of knowledge of Dionysius' network at Corinth itself among bishops that succeeded him?
Gosh, I wish I knew that. You know, literally, there is Dionysius,
yeah,
and that, and then we have a mention of Bacchylus in the Quartus Decimus controversy. That's it.
Yeah.
literally, nothing else. You know, I mean, there's maybe a couple little martyr traditions and stuff,
yeah,
right?
So,
but
like Quadratus,
yeah,
and
You know, he could be a bishop, but he might not. He might just be a kind of, you know, Christian sort of sophist of sorts, we could say. I mean, I'm really curious, you know, what we think happens in the third century, if there is some continuous line of, you know, a guy who is called by other bishops Bishop of Corinth and who calls himself Bishop of Corinth.
I would love
and
to
when
know,
Eusebius
yeah.
is writing, I mean, certainly when Eusebius is writing, there is a guy who's Bishop of Corinth. I think it's Alexander or something like that.
Something like that, I can't remember
or
exactly.
A little later. Anyway, but... So whether or not that continuity survives or not at Corinth, I think it's an interesting question for the third century.
So like the way that I think about it is that like when you look at how Eusebius talks about the entire collection, he gives you no other information about than what he's reading in the letters.
Right.
Yeah. So he doesn't all of his descriptions like, oh, these are great letters and they say this stuff.
Yeah.
But he doesn't have any other stories.
Yeah.
Jerome uses Eusebius, adds nothing to it.
Right.
Harnack thought that there were some free-floating quotes around there that were in John of Damascus, where John of Damascus says they're from Ignatius, but he thought, Harnack was like, no, they must be from Dionysius. Mm-hmm. That's probably not true. Some people think that Second Clement is somehow involved in either being Penitos's letter, but that doesn't really make a whole lot of sense either. Basically, I think what we know about Christianity in Corinth outside of First Clement's quotes about Hegesippus, Dionysius, we have little fragments of like Tertullian saying that they still veiled their virgins, though I have no idea how Tertullian knows that. And then I think Origen says something about how the Corinthians were Orthodox or something, but again, how does Origen know that? Like, and they're just little offhand comments. So there's just... there's not much, you know. I would love to know more. Yeah. And I, ultimately, though, like nobody else seems to know about Dionysius. Mm-hmm. And we know that like his letters go out, and we know that they get corrupted from Dionysius' own account. He says like, I sent out all these letters. I think I put this quote up earlier. I wrote all these letters as people deem me to write, but the apostles of the devil filled them with weeds. Right. So he sends some letters out. And then they get sort of, I mean, there's enough social capital behind his letters that they get reused, right, in some way. We don't really exactly know how that works. So then he issues kind of his own authoritative collection.
So he,
by doing that, he makes something available to Eusebius down the road.
Yeah.
But how Penitos's letter gets in there no idea how that happens, right? That seems counter to the whole point.
Right. So if Dionysius is making his own collection, maybe he includes that in his own collection.
Yeah, there are good and bad reasons for that. Yeah. Bauer had some reasons why he wouldn't include it, and Nothan thought it was sort of added later. There's a whole amongst like the three of us who do this, right? There's some discussion about like how did that collection come together, and we have no idea. Ultimately, have no idea how it comes together. So it goes around. And it gets made into a textual product that is then copied in some way, or at least distributed in some way. Mm-hmm. But the knowledge of that distribution, the valence of Dionysius' writings for others, is totally lost to us.
Yeah.
To me, it just reminds me that like so many of the texts that we work with in studying early Christianity are just completely stripped of their context.
Mm-hmm.
Right, the Gospels are stripped of their context. Tons and tons of things are stripped of their context, and they're kind of rebuilt and restructured with kind of orthodox or heretical categories to give them some sort of contextual framework. Or we mine them in modernity for little clues to where what their communities might have been. But ultimately, we don't have that stuff, and so I think early Christianity is better seen as this sort of series of networks that we don't have much access to that kind of come together. And then they break apart, and either they disappear or pieces of them float around and get grafted into new constructions.
Mm-hmm.
There's no reason to my mind why Melito of Sardis should be Orthodox, yet he somehow is, right? Like, that's because he's been captured by this discourse and read against what he actually says about Christology. To me, a model for thinking about this is that things break apart and then they come together in new ways, and that new coming together tends to sort of reconfigure everything. So Dionysius becomes Orthodox because Eusebius reads him intentionally as an Orthodox bishop. And he does this despite the fact that he's also arguing with another Orthodox bishop.
Cool. Very
interesting.
Thank you, Kevin, very much. In this paper today and in other things that you've published, you've done a wonderful job of demonstrating how the frames that Eusebius constructs around what he tells us about Dionysius, how they skew and how they influence the way that we read. Mm-hmm. So in the first quote that you have up there, the first one must say concerning Dionysius that he was entrusted with the seat of the bishop in the district of Corinth. Mm-hmm. At the time of First Clement, it's clear that there is no single bishop. Mm-hmm. The government is presbyterial.
Yeah.
Alan Brent has argued that at the time of the Shepherd of Hermas, mm-hmm. in Rome, that there is also no single bishop. The government is presbyterial.
Yeah.
I'm trying to recall the exact wording of the text of Hegesippus that Eusebius quotes. He talks, when Hegesippus comes to mm-hmm. Corinth in, what, about 150?
Somewhere
or
around
so?
There, yeah.
So it's prior mm-hmm. to Dionysius and Soter. When Hegesippus comes through Corinth on his way to Rome, he talks about spending time with the Corinthians and being refreshed in his spirit, and he praises their maintaining the orthos logos, right, the true teaching. But I don't think Hegesippus mentions a bishop, does he?
He does, actually. He mentions
the bishop
Primus.
In Rome.
No, he mentions that he hangs out with a guy named Primus while he's in Corinth.
Oh, okay.
I think he calls them their bishop. Yeah.
Does he call him their bishop?
Well, at least by Eusebius' rendering, I think he does. I'm trying to remember exactly.
Well, this is my question. My question is, how confident can we be in viewing Dionysius of Corinth as the mon episcopos if the government is still presbyterial at Corinth a little bit earlier in the time of Clement, and if it's still presbyterial in Rome in the time of Hermas?
So I think I'm persuaded by Pedro Lampo, who would say that Rome doesn't get a monepiscopal structure until Victor, even after Soter, and that Soter is still basically functioning as a kind of bishop of foreign relations, basically. That's, I think, Lampa's description of that situation. So, and I love Alan Brent's work on Ignatius, where he talks about how he doesn't think that people in Asia Minor thought of themselves as bishops until Ignatius suggests it. And Brent has this really wonderful phrase, imagining sort of what it would be like for someone like, you know, one of these bishops that is addressed by Ignatius' letters to be called bishop. And he says, well, I've never been called a bishop. I've always been a presbyter. But everyone kind of does defer to me. So, yeah, I'm a bishop. Okay, cool, right? So Brent almost sort of thinks of like Ignatius kind of inventing bishops all over the place. So it's not entirely clear. Because we're dealing with Eusebius, it's not entirely clear that Dionysius refers to himself as a bishop. We can't trust that we know that. It seems, though, in his letter to the Athenians, so there, if Eusebius is sort of describing the situation right, that there's been a bishop in Athens who's been killed and who is now being replaced by somebody else, and Dionysius writes to support him, basically. So maybe what we're dealing with is Dionysius writing in support of a bishop, a single bishop in Athens. Again, I don't know. I mean, it's hard to know whether or not Eusebius is basically just throwing bishop around, right? Or whether we just have, you know, somebody who just writes letters because he's particularly well-respected. It's not entirely clear to me. So that's probably the only evidence that I think I could sort of say that really kind of fits that. Precisely because I think that when Dionysius does refer to Soter, there I think he's also referring to him as somebody who is sort of part of a broader network of presbyter bishops in Rome still. So.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
There are three requirements to have a good conference. One is to have good papers. The other one is to have something